Climb into the cockpit with pilot and Wing Square's Chief Legal Officer, Tim Perilla, as he invites legal leaders aboard to share advice that will help you navigate even the most turbulent times of in-house counsel work. We'll cover a range of topics from data privacy to legal team structure to public company transactions and beyond. You don't want to miss this series. Fasten your seatbelt and prepare for takeoff. You're listening to Cockpit Counsel.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Cockpit Counsel. My name is Tim, and I'm the Chief Legal Officer at Link Squares.
And I'm Alyssa Verzino, producer and co-host of the show. Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoy the show, don't forget to like, follow, and subscribe. Now let's jump into our next episode.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Cockpit Counsel. With us this week, we have Alyssa Harrington. Alyssa is the Deputy GC of All Elite Wrestling. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
So Cockpit Counsel is pilot themed. We start every episode the same way. What is your pre-flight ritual?
So with a traveling wrestling show, I spend quite a bit of time in airports and on planes. And so for me, it's about finding the right podcast or YouTube thing that I'm going to download on my phone and have ready to go.
Just in case the Wi-Fi doesn't work.
Exactly. Yeah. Just in case the Wi-Fi isn't going to work. And then making sure that I have some electrolytes, my hand lotion, and my lip balm, because the planes are very dry.
They are. It's tough to keep moisture in the air in a pressurized contained environment.
Yes, we are basically in a pressurized can flying through the air. So it's
a miracle. It's really a miracle.
It truly is. It is.
So let's talk a little bit about your career path. You had a super interesting career path. We'd love to hear from you just how you ended up at AEW.
Sure, of course. Well, I actually started way back when in undergrad, I double majored in comparative religious studies and in political science.
Very clear path straight clear. To pro wrestling.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely clear path, especially through law and pro wrestling.
Of course.
And so the first place I ended up going was working in electoral politics and in the Minnesota House of Representatives. So I worked specifically in constituent services there, which I tell people this, that my religion degree came in far more helpful than my political science degree.
Okay.
Because it was a lot about trying to figure out what other people believe, why they're believing it, why they're asking questions, and then bridging that gap with them.
Right.
Which is something that in comparative religious studies, when you're looking at how these conflicts evolve and what are the factors behind them, is really applicable to both the electoral politics, the legislative politics, and then moving forward into law and actually professional wrestling.
All right. So with the sort of dealing with constituents on a day in and day out basis, like what was kind of your mandate from your elected representative that like how were you towing the line between like, okay, this is, you know, these are hard lines for me as a politician versus I can be flexible on the margins here and there.
Yeah, that's a really good question, especially because I didn't have one specific politician I worked for.
Okay.
I worked for an entire caucus.
Oh, no kidding.
And okay. So at one point I used to joke, I had 97 bosses.
Yeah.
and each one of them had their own unique take on things. There were items that, you know, kind of mandates that came down from the caucus saying this is how we're going to respond to something. But a lot of it came down to trying to match people's voice, trying to respect their communication style so that it sounded like them, because in some ways I was ghostwriting.
Right.
And then also to toe that line between is this something as an elected where, let's say, a constituent brought a problem forward and I looked into it and it turns out that there really was something that needed a law change, and that was usually our last resort. If
right.
Usually we could use make phone calls, do other things to really get things figured out in a different way. But if it did need a law change, then my job was to act as the advocate in some ways for the constituent of bringing that concern forward. It didn't mean it would get solved, but it meant that at least that concern was heard. And a lot of time that's all people wanted, was to know that their concern was heard by someone in power and that it was thoroughly looked into.
So how did your, one of your many, many bosses, how did you coordinate that communication, and what was that like? I imagine it's probably like trying to juggle 1,000 balls while on a unicycle or something like this.
That is a really good way of describing it. And occasionally someone would set a ball on fire.
Okay. Yeah.
Because you would, all of a sudden something would blow up and you'd have to take care of that item. But we had a incredibly rudimentary database system. I'm aging myself here a bit, but we had a Access database that was set up.
Actually, really easy to query.
Easy to query.
Yeah.
And so I love a good database. Yeah. And so we had a team of us, and so we would get requests in, and then either we would be tracking them in the database, or we would be working with the legislative assistants and other people to track them. So there was a big need, though, depending on how sensitive the issue was, to have a conversation with them. And so it's kind of similar to some of the things I do now, because I would be tracking people down on the House floor. I would be tracking people down in the hallways, outside of committee rooms, wherever it was I could get their attention for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So it definitely meant learning very quickly early on how to be precise in what I needed from someone, and to present a true executive summary to someone of like, this is what I need. These are the risks. This is what, you know, your options are. What would you like to do? Here's what we would suggest.
Right, right. So this was all before you went to law school, right?
Yes.
Okay. So then you decide, all right, I want to go to law school. What was there? Was there a particular point where, was it the desire for a career change? What made you go to law school?
Yeah, so I'm going to step back half a step, because I actually got a master's degree first in advocacy and political leadership from a really innovative program that focuses on the practical effects of it. And it's important to talk about that, because I got to meet some fantastic lobbyists in D.C., in St. Paul, in leaders in Congress, who became mentors to me. And when I was starting to look at what the next steps of my career were, all of them said to me, you know, I think you need to find something where you're solving puzzles. That seems to be where you're happiest. And after kind of switching to go into the Department of Human Services in Minnesota, so the executive branch, very quickly within the first 6 months, it became clear that I wouldn't be able to get a promotion from my job unless I had a JD.
Yeah.
And so I kind of went back and spoke with some of the people, and three of them were actually law school dropouts.
Okay.
And all three of them said, it wasn't for me, but I think it's for you.
Yeah.
And they were right.
Yeah. So you ended up deciding to go to law school.
Yes.
And then did you end up going back into government from there?
So I stayed in government. Okay. I went to a night program it's now Mitchell Hamlin, but it was St. Paul Law School back in the day when Warren Berger and others went to it. And it has even back then it had a night program.
Okay.
And so I was in the evening program my first year, and then I continued to work in actually child support and policy through.
That's a tough.
It was, yes. There's a reason I do not do family law.
Yeah, yeah.
I have the utmost respect for the people who do, because it's such a, I was more on the technical side of it. I was at the state level. And so I worked a lot with the mathematical formulas that we used and how we do arrears management, and really the psychology of how do people who owe money view it, and what can you do to help get them to pay?
Right.
But that's beside the point.
it's like the family side, the child welfare side, and Innocence Project. Like anybody who works in those fields, I have no idea how they like, you know, you think about it, I'm sure you take your work home with you mentally and emotionally in some ways. Imagine, I mean, I can't even imagine being in that area and trying to do that. You got a lot of respect for those people.
Yeah, I do too. And it's such a one of my passions is making sure that in the legal field, people are recognizing the secondary trauma aspects of it.
Right.
And so in particular, those areas are all so high for that in particular. It's have so much respect for them, and my heart goes out to them.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy stuff.
It is.
So sorry. Completely no. Sidetracked.
It happens with me a lot. Don't worry.
No. Me too. We could probably go on. Just let's, as long as we don't get into like talking about outside counsel management, where we'll just go on for hours. Then
oh, we'll it would be hours too.
Literally hours.
Yes.
So, all right. So you're going to school at night, still working now for the executive branch.
Yes. And I ended up getting a opportunity to work in the federal courts in Minnesota. Okay. Particularly with the settlement with persons with disabilities in Minnesota, which meant I had to cut off my contact with the Department of Human Services for a while to do that. So I spent a semester doing that, a summer at a law firm in Minneapolis doing my let's see what big law is like type of thing. And then I went back to government and was working there through the time that I graduated law school and was preparing for the bar.
Yeah.
And then unfortunately my brother passed away 3 days before I was supposed to take the bar.
Oh.
And that really changed my view on what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it. And so it ended up being a good opportunity to make a switch, and I went to clerk in serious felonies in Minneapolis, which is completely different from everything else.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it a great deal. It was challenging.
Yeah.
I got to solve those puzzles.
Yeah.
And when I walked in, the judge who I worked for, the very first thing that he said to me, or one of the first things, was he viewed the job of the judiciary and the clerks to be the ones who reached out to the people who were in the courtroom, regardless of in what role, and walk with them to where they needed to go. And he stole my line that I had always used in job interviews. And so I said, I think this is a good place to figure out kind of what I wanted to do next. And it was.
Yeah. The clerkship experience, everybody I've talked, I didn't have one, but everyone I've talked to, particularly who's been on the criminal side of it, has said that it's just meaningfully shaped their career and has always allowed them to keep perspective on what they're doing, especially when we're like talking about contracts and you know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. I after that, I went into local government at a medium-sized firm that represents smaller communities throughout Minnesota, and I acted as general counsel, as a prosecutor, as a special counsel, all types of things like that, and it was especially helpful there to have that perspective.
Yeah.
And because there too, you're dealing with cases, even if it's as simple as something where you're trying to get someone to mow their lawn. Well, it's never just about usually. It's not about them not mowing their lawn.
Right.
It's really about what's going on with the family, what's going on with the people behind the really tall grass.
Right, right. So then you end up at AEW. Meaningful shift.
Yes. Although, as I've noted to several people, and several people have noted, going from politics to wrestling is strangely not as weird of a jump coming from Minnesota, where we had Jesse Ventura as a governor.
Well, that's right. That's right.
And given our current president is in a wrestling hall of fame, it's perhaps a little bit more of a closely aligned.
Yeah. It's a closer relationship.
Right? Yes. but yes, I ended up at AEW. So back when I was in law school, I just needed a JD, right? I thought I was going to continue in government and just needed kind of that check mark. So I took the classes that interested me with the assumption that if I did that, then I would do better in them. And that worked. And so I ended up specializing in intellectual property, specifically trademarks and copyrights. And I wrote on and eventually was the editor-in-chief of our intellectual property law journal.
Cool.
And so I wrote my article and kind of my, you know, you don't really get a thesis in law school, but as much as you do, I wrote it on the treatment of wrestling ring names by the USPTO as trademarks.
No kidding.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. That's awesome.
Thank you. It was.
What made you pick that topic?
Yeah. So there were kind of two things. So my husband has been a huge fan of wrestling and was really interested in the business of wrestling. Mm-hmm. He had a podcast that he did for quite a number of years where he would use his analytical skills. He, in his quote-unquote day job, he was doing a lot of spreadsheets. He's kind of the data god at work now. And he was realizing as I was going through law school that there were ways that he could leverage what I was learning to inform what he was doing.
Okay.
And one of those ways was that when you're filing trademarks, you can file prior to use.
Right.
So to protect it beforehand. Yep. And he realized that was a really good way to predict where other wrestling companies or where the only wrestling company at the time, where they were going,
right,
who they were signing,
yep,
where the storylines were going, and kind of predictively do that.
Okay.
And so he started doing that and looking at it. And the more that we looked at it, the more we realized that there was a very odd treatment by the USPTO of trademarks and wrestling ring names, because sometimes ring names, what you're called on the screen, are your own name.
Yep.
And there are obviously a lot of trademark laws and case law that goes with that.
Yep.
But we were finding cases where even when that was the case, the identifiers weren't getting recognized as being identifying a real person. We also found instances, famously I found an instance where someone's ring name there was a secondary kind of trademark, like a nickname that was getting added on.
Okay.
And they did not, the USPTO sent back a letter saying, we think that this is identifying a real living person, and then had their ring name.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
And so we were like, oh, this is what happens when like you don't know an industry deeply, which I don't blame the examiner for this. At least they found it.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where unless you have knowledge of kind of how the industry works, you wouldn't recognize why that would be so common.
Right, right. That's pretty wild. So how big is your team there?
So my legal team is three people.
Okay.
It's myself, our general counsel and SVP, and then we have a full-time law clerk who just graduated law school this past December and is preparing for the bar in July. So
nice.
Looking forward to him coming on full as an attorney, of course, in October.
So take me through kind of a typical day.
If there
is a typical day.
We joke that it's sort of like that Star Trek meme of Jean-Luc Picard, who's like in the captain's chair being like, status report.
Right.
Just like wake up and you're like, okay, what happened overnight? Because we have certainly, you know, because of the way that the wrestling world works, things happen 24 hours a day. There's always things going on. We're in a 24-hour news cycle. And if you bring that down to, you know, in some of these industries like wrestling, where you have this niche group of people who are online, who are journalists, who are always kind of trying to get that next scoop, that next thing, that next piece, there's always something to look at. Plus, when we have shows, they usually run until, depending on which coast we're on or internationally, they can run to any hour of the evening.
Right.
And then there's always the aftermath.
Right, right.
And so I'm pretty sure my circadian rhythm is no longer a rhythm. Okay. It is...
you live in a series of naps.
Yes, I pretty much live in a series of naps, and as does the entire legal team at this point.
Yeah.
We try to trade off to make sure that someone gets some time at home to actually sleep and do normal human things for a while the other one or two of us go on the road.
Yeah. So, so you go on the road, going to the events, going to the shows. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So we have two weekly TV shows, Dynamite and Collision. Mm-hmm. And then we also run the Ring of Honor brand, which we tape on a weekly or every other week basis. And then it's shown on a video on demand service. And then we also have our big special live events where we've been in Wembley, we've been in Australia, we're going to possibly more countries that we're announcing very soon.
Nice.
And so those take a lot of, these big events can run days in advance for preparation, both for literally setting up the event. It's, if you imagine, you have sets, you have basically an entire arena full of rigging and lighting and a ring and sound production in a different place every 3 days.
It's crazy. It's like doing several music tours all at once.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. We work with some folks, wonderful folks who work with a couple of touring acts. Mm-hmm. And they're always laughing at us because we're just like, we don't know. We won't know until we get there. They'll be like, well, which exit, you know, which entrance should we bring someone to? We're like, I'll tell you the day of.
Right.
Because if we haven't been there before, we have to do all of the planning for EMTs, for exits, for safety, for egress in the back hallways, all of it. The day before and the day of.
Yeah, absolutely. So when it's interesting to hear that the legal team is traveling to these shows, what kind of stuff are you encountering to the extent you're comfortable sharing?
Yeah, of course. Thank you. And so we have a couple of different areas. One, we have professional wrestling is actually a regulated industry in 20-some states.
Okay.
And so depending on which one it is, those regulations can also come with a commission. And so there'll be government inspectors and commission members who come in to check that people are licensed, that they've gone through the right physicals, that some of them take the blood pressure the day of.
Okay.
And then they'll have rules about who can and cannot wrestle and what even moves they can and cannot do.
Okay.
And so, for instance, there's sometimes a communication that needs to happen in a government relations way, right? Of kind of talking back and forth and saying, like, your regulation says this. I understand that. Your regulation says no bleeding.
Yeah.
Which is a common one.
Right.
There's what happens if we call it hard way, which is if you naturally get cut in a ring.
Right. Like something happens.
Yes, something happens unexpectedly. Yeah. There is unexpected blood.
Right.
Do we have to stop the match? Or can we bandage the person ringside?
Right.
And if so, how many seconds?
Right.
How long? And then negotiating that of saying, well, I understand, you know, we'll try to get it stopped as soon as possible. My medical team is saying it's going to take them 2 minutes.
Right.
Because it's physically, yes, they're right there, they're ringside, but it's a human. And so can we get a little bit of leeway on that?
Yeah.
Because it's not specified.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things. And so it's hosting them, bringing them around, making sure that they have everything they need and everyone's following the directions. We have issues that come up. I was joking with some people recently that the number one question I get asked is, can I say this? which
well.
Usually the answer is no, and you know you can't say that. But we have a lot of talent who are incredibly creative. One of the best things about working at AEW is all of the creative people we get to work with.
Yeah.
And so it does mean that we will get phone calls like I did earlier this week asking, can we say slop tart?
On
TV.
Right.
And I was like, well, I think you already did.
Right.
I'm pretty sure I saw that Saturday night. But more to the point, are you really asking, can you say it again? And he's like, yes, that can we say it again? And
can I make it my thing for the next like 2 months? Yeah.
And can we put it on a t-shirt?
Right, right.
That was the next question was, can we put it on a t-shirt?
That's so brilliant.
And so we get a lot of those types of questions backstage. Yeah. And so it's helpful to just have someone there where you can immediately bounce it off them and be like, hey, can I do this? And, you know, in that case, I was like, I think so. Why don't you tell me what you think it means?
Okay.
And I will do my own Google search.
Right.
And we'll compare. And then I actually did find a product, which are compressed sponges.
Okay.
So see, I wouldn't have thought of that given the context of the word, but.
Yeah, that's not what would have come to mind for me either.
No.
So one thing you touched on, the regulatory aspect, the oversight. Is that within your purview? Are you the one going and building relationships with those commissions, and or is it kind of all of you on the team, or are there other parts of the organization that also foster those relationships? How are you interacting with the regulators there?
So it's really it's a team effort. We have to provide a lot of information, legal information, medical information. I work very closely with our medical team on data privacy, HIPAA, and then on just how we're storing the data, literally what products are we using, making sure that the security and safety is up to snuff, and then what precautions are we taking to make sure that that information stays secure when we're sharing it with a government entity.
Okay.
And the other part of it is we have to have a named promoter. So there is usually one person whose name has to go on the application. And I mentioned earlier that my husband and I were the ones who kind of looked into the trademarks.
Yeah.
Well, my husband was actually the first employee at AEW.
Oh, no kidding.
And so since those first days, he has been the named promoter.
Fun.
Yes. and so we joke that he had his reservations about me coming to the company, as any spouse would, working with your spouse.
There's a lot.
There's a lot.
There's a lot, yeah.
Until he realized he had his very owned personal in-house counsel.
Yep.
Literally upstairs from him.
That's
and
helpful.
It is.
Yeah.
So I've seen it from that perspective as well. So it's odd. Honestly, sometimes it's him and I double checking paperwork just to make sure we have everything, because we have 185 people approximately on our roster at any given time. So it's a lot of data, a lot of private data, and a lot of applications to manage.
Yeah.
So the two of us tend to tag team when we're dealing with the commissions.
Yeah, that was one of the things that we really focused on heavily at DraftKings as before sports betting started to become legalized after the Supreme Court decision in 2018. We were working with a lot of different regulatory agencies to try to get oversight for fantasy sports, right? And prior to that Supreme Court decision, we were working with various stakeholders throughout different state governments and trying to figure out how we can get how we could get clarity in certain jurisdictions around the operation of paid fantasy sports. And those relationships proved to be invaluable, and we were able to have have this relationship of like being able to tell the regulators what was going on before, because regulators rarely like to be the last people to find out about something.
Oh,
right.
Having been on both sides of it,
yeah,
I hated it when I was when I was on the regulatory side.
Yeah,
I hated being the last one that knew about a new project, a new law that was coming out, and especially the number one way to cause our entire team when I was a regulator to go against you was to not tell us you were getting a bill introduced by someone in this.
Right.
And don't give us any warning.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, when you do build those relationships, and they really are like ongoing relationships, after, you know, like you think about for us, like particularly in sports betting, sports betting was pretty new for a lot of jurisdictions other than Nevada.
Yep.
Right. And a lot of these commissioners, staff of the commission, they didn't have a full understanding on, you know, everything that it took to actually run a book, actually put markets out there, how to, you know, verify your customer, right? And so, but these people are the people that are promulgating the regulations that seek to regulate the activity itself. And so through like those relationships, like post passage of the bill, we were able to work with them, and in my mind, we came to a lot of really positive outcomes through the regulatory change process. And then after that, you know who you can call, and they knew who they could call too. Like folks in New Jersey, be like, "All right, I need to call up DraftKings." Be like, "Hey, what's going on?" Be like, "Oh, hey, sorry, Lou, I was literally going to call you later today. This is what's going on." Right? Like that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, we've actually worked with DraftKings AW, and have run into some of the same issues on a different scale, which is we are looking at, I don't think I'm breaking kayfabe, which is to say we have our own language that we speak in wrestling, and kayfabe means kind of protecting the secrets, protecting the ambiance. And but most people know that there are people backstage who probably have a pretty good idea of who's going to win a wrestling match. I'll put it that way. And
I guess
they might have an idea.
Yeah.
And so when we're talking about those types of things with betting, it comes into a whole new set of challenges.
Yeah.
And when you add on top of that being on broadcast TV, you have fun with federal agencies as well, and trying to figure out how can you promote things? How can we not promote things?
Yeah.
Can we put a logo on TV and not mention it in, have our announcers read it?
Yeah.
Can we do it the other way? Does it matter if we're doing this internationally?
Yeah.
How does that change?
Yeah. I mean, I just think I think that relationship started after I left. Like, when did you guys partner?
Like, it was pretty early, but it was, 2019, 2020.
Okay. The interesting thing about for DraftKings is that we have restrictions on how we're able to advertise markets because it's state by state, but you're obviously broadcasting nationally.
Exactly.
And so like that was, we also like earlier on for fantasy, we had a deal with UFC, and that was one of the big things that we were like, all right, we have to have particular logo placement that can't be like digitally overlaid. It's got to be actually there, because that allows us to have the logo shown on a nationwide basis. Whereas if it were a digital placement or maybe a different type of ring placement, we would ultimately have it blurred out.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And we have certainly, there are all kinds of those regulations that are state to state and even venue to venue. I mean, we're working with 100 and some venues a year usually. Each one of them has their own requirements, especially you know, I one of the things I did as a municipal attorney is that I worked with state bonded projects.
Oh, yeah.
And those included arenas and amphitheaters and theaters. And we go to those now.
Right.
And so they have very strict restrictions beyond even what you would get from the regulators about what kind of advertising, what kind of sponsors or other things you might be dealing with. And so that's something that we deal with a lot as well.
Yeah.
So you know the fun of having the spreadsheets of 50 different states and trying to make sure you know what the controlling, not just the controlling law, but physically where something's going on.
Yeah, exactly. I always thought it was a cool part of the job, though.
Yeah.
Like it's something that I think a lot of people in other industries don't really get to experience in the same way that you're currently, and I was able to experience in sports.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fun thing to be able, and it gives you a really wide perspective, I think, on just the importance of knowing who you're talking to, knowing what their needs are.
Yeah.
Understanding that if you're talking to a regulator, they have a job to do.
Right.
But they also are probably overwhelmed. And as you pointed out, probably don't know about the ins and outs.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is just education.
Yeah.
And needing to be able to provide that education in a way that's not condescending, that's more inviting people into your world.
Yeah. And you think about it, especially if you have different government agencies, like gaming commissions are easy, right? But like when you talk about like regulating different types of activities, you may have an agency, like, for example, you know, we had with Fantasy, the attorney general's office in some circumstances had addressed this issue, right, and had promulgated sort of rules of how to operate fantasy sports contests consistent with how the AG is interpreting the law and things. And you're talking to these people, and it's the AG's office, and they're probably just coming from something that, like, dealing with somebody where it's the worst day of their life, and then having to completely switch to a different topic. And then after you, they're going somewhere else. And it's just like, it's crazy. So you're right. Like building that relationship and having the empathy for the regular, like honestly, very few of them have been like, I just want to stop. I just want to say no to everybody.
Yeah.
Right. Like most of them are like, actually, I'm just trying to do my job.
Exactly. And, yeah. And it, you know, having been on both sides of it now, part of being on the regulatory side is also you want to say yes, but.
Of course.
You want to be able to still say, you know, we're keeping people safe, we're keeping things, preventing fraud. We're doing all of those things that are kind of those core government functions, and figuring out which one it is when you're on the outside that they're trying to follow can sometimes be challenging too, of like, well, are we doing this because, for instance, in our industry, are we doing this because it is a safety issue, because it's a medical issue, because it's you want to make sure that people have enough resources if something goes wrong? Like, what is which lever are we pulling here?
Right.
And once you figure that out, it's much easier to have that conversation of being like, okay, let's figure out a reasonable solution here.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And this sounds like a very crazy day to day. So what type of mindset do you need to have to be successful in that environment?
I think one of the biggest things that I need to be able to do is to separate kind of this is a legal issue from this is something about the chaos of the day. Like, I can be backstage and I can have some discrete legal issues I need to deal with. But at the same time, all around me, I have people who are literally smashing bottles, using weapons, running up and down hallways, trying to, you know, legitimately getting hurt, unfortunately, sometimes, getting medical treatment. It can be a little bit crazy backstage. We have, you know, when we were in arenas, a lot of them are cramped backstage, so you're kind of tripping over each other. And you have to take that into account. And so I think a big part of it is giving people as much grace as possible mm-hmm. on the day of events and just recognizing it is. And to keep that in perspective, I try at every show at least once to go out into the crowd mm-hmm. and to see their reaction to an amazing match, mm-hmm. to see how they pop and they cheer when someone's making an entrance, to see how the music that I cleared earlier in the week is suddenly getting people on their feet and making that connection between the really creative, positive goal that we're all trying to get to, mm-hmm. which is to basically write a love letter to wrestling. Mm-hmm. And keeping that in perspective is so important to making sure that you can keep the legal issues where they belong mm-hmm. and separate and not let kind of the craziness of the day affect how you're making those legal calls.
That's awesome. That's a great mindset and good reminder. And then when it comes to the legal practice, you manage a ton of different things.
Yes.
So how do you keep it all straight? And also, what role does tech play in it?
Tech plays a huge role in it, to be honest, because we have such a small team. Mm-hmm. And when I was coming in, I started the same week as our IT director, mm-hmm. our first IT director. And so we had several years at that point of all of our infrastructure and all of our data and everything that had kind of grown up in silos. And so a lot of what I do on the tech side of it, because I'm really involved in that side of our business as well, is look where we can make interconnections, mm-hmm. where we can make it so that people have access to the right information at the right time, because that means they'll make the right decisions. And trying to move us from an idea of data being a commodity to data being how we make good decisions as a business. We also have people coming from the wrestling world more directly, which means maybe they haven't used a laptop for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so trying to make sure to really get people, again, as we said earlier, meeting people where they are, mm-hmm. figuring out what it is that is going to allow them to use the technology in a way that supports everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And AI is increasingly shaping the legal field as well. So how do you see its role evolving for in-house professionals?
Yeah, so AI is both really, I often at work say that lawyers aren't going to get replaced by AI, mm-hmm. but lawyers who don't use AI wisely are going to get replaced
yeah.
by lawyers yeah. who do.
It's a great, great way to phrase it.
Because I can now look at, I can use AI to do a lot of the things that a computer is better at. Like a computer is going to be better at catching tiny mistakes. I think of it as, we all of a certain age are pretty comfortable now with using spell check.
Yeah.
And I view a lot of the AI as it's coming as being better and better versions of spell check in a lot of what we do. And then the analytics. I mean, it can't be downplayed how much the legal field, how much analytics is playing into the legal field now and how much it's going to in the future. And how important AI is going to be in all of that. Not to mention the fact that when we start getting into AI and entertainment and sports, that could be a whole other podcast
yeah.
episode, to
yeah.
be honest, just with how fast that is moving and trying to put the legal protections around people's images, around their moves, around all of that. You mentioned earlier about digitally inserting or removing logos. Yeah. And that's a huge thing now that we're running into is people and places where that is or is not allowed.
The tech is getting so you watch any NHL broadcast.
Yeah.
And it's just like nothing is real.
No.
Until they show the instant replay, nothing is real.
No.
It's wild.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And it's so different from the live experience then, which is,
yeah,
I working in a, you know, also in an industry where we have the live version and then we have the version on TV.
Yeah.
You know, it's fascinating to me how different sports have decided to make those two experiences so differentiated.
Yeah.
Whereas we try to always make it more like you're there.
Right.
Which is just a different way of doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. All right. Well, we end every episode with some rapid fire questions.
Okay.
So if you're ready, what is your hot take on working in-house in sports law?
You don't have to be an athlete to do it, but you should probably figure out what your favorite protein shake is.
That's awesome. What is your number one tip on balancing good use of AI with bad use of AI?
If it is creating something that makes you think, ooh, that looks like a deep fake, don't do it.
If you could give only one piece of legal advice to someone running a lean legal team, what would it be?
Make technology your friend.
Nice. And then we always end every episode the same way. What is a charity or a cause that's close to your heart that you want all of our listeners to check out?
Sure. So it's something that's very close to my heart. They were very helpful to me when I lost my brother. And so it's TAPS, okay. The Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors. And they work nationally with the family survivors of military members and veterans who have died in some kind of tragic way, including accidents, crimes, suicide, etc.
Okay.
They do amazing work.
Awesome. Well, we'll definitely get, and when we promote the episode, we'll definitely make sure we promote that as well.
Great.
So, well, Alyssa, thanks so much for joining us. It was a great conversation. And yeah, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for joining us. And if you have any topics for discussion or guests you'd like to see on the show, feel free to submit them to cockpitcouncil@linksquares.com.